right, this feels...
Whatever.
Hello?
Oh, yes, it's on. Okay, so I apologize for my tardiness, but I'm back. Hello. So in the high school, we've had parent-teacher conferences, two successful runs of them, and so that went well, of course. And then there was, on Friday, there was a talent show. A lot of my friends were involved. I have to say the talent was almost through the roof. It was phenomenal. I actually haven't attended them in the previous year, but this year I was very glad that I have seen clips and videos, and made me a little emotional seeing some of my friends on stage. And then on Saturday was the SAT. I could only assume. I didn't take the SAT, but I could only assume it went well. The DECA club, I suppose you can call it, is having a kickball tournament, if the weather permits us to have it, tomorrow. And tomorrow's Tuesday. I have to do the date in my head real quick. Tomorrow's Tuesday. Wednesday we have elf. Thursday is the family fun night of this district. So that means on Friday we can't have... I apologize for my handwriting. One second. So Friday there are no tests given, and Friday... So that's good for me. And Friday also ends our first quarter. Successful first quarter for everyone, I hope. The 19th is a blood drive. And the fall play... which the rehearsals are going fantastic, is on the 20th and the 21st at 8 p.m. And being in the show, I have a personal bias to ask you to come see it. And that is all. Thank you.
Before the meeting gets started, I'd like to read a little now. Statement. It's got to do with the our community and adult behavior. It's come to our attention that over the past few weeks, we've had several incidents of unacceptable parental behavior in our schools during parent-teacher conferences and during the PSAT day. Parents yelling at and acting in an aggressive manner towards any staff member and or each other will not be tolerated. We understand that we may not always agree with each other on all issues, and we expect you to be a passionate advocate for your children. However, while you may be frustrated or upset, our expectation is that you will express it in a respectful manner. We, the adults, the teachers, administrators, and other staff members of the Board of Education and parents must model the kind of civility and respectful behavior we expect from our children. One of our goals for the year is the creation of an adult conduct policy that will supplement the district's code of conduct and our DASA policies. While we put this policy together, the board asks that we will all think about our behavior and do our best to act in a way that will make us proud of our community. Thank you. Board announcements? Emily.
Yes, the other night, a couple of board members and I attended the talent night, which Mr. Goldsmith referred to, and I just wanted to comment on number one, what a pleasure it was to watch, and number two, what a great range of interests our students showed, from mixed media to song to Guzheng, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Chinese zither. It was really a phenomenal range, and I'm all for education, but some of these kids could just go straight to being studio musicians like tomorrow. It was really a phenomenal show.
Any others? Grab a mic, Laura.
I'd like to just thank the high school PTA for inviting us to the high school parents' night out at La Familia. I was very happy to attend. It was a great and fun night, so thank you. I also went to the Parkway Halloween party, which was always a blast. So it was a great week and a lot of fun. Kids had a ball. Lots of fun dancing. I also attended Family Bagels, had 10 years, but in addition to that, they had a great fundraiser for a child in our district who is battling leukemia, and it was a great turnout for that, and then we, of course, wish him well.
Anyone else? Do you have anything? I have one thing. Last week, Newsday published an article about estimated TRS and ERS contribution rates for the 16-17 school year. In the article, they had an estimate of 11.75%, which I guess, Rich, this is just in time for the budget cycle. So I just want to confirm that in doing the that rate is in line with our current budget and financial planning. It's also important to note that this is a rolling five-year average, so barring any stock market collapse, we should see TRS continue to drop off or level off in future years.
Just to respond to that, that rate is to be used for next year's budgeting projections. So this year's rate was actually set last year, so we'll be using that range to set our TRS accrual for the 16-17 fiscal year.
Deputy Superintendent?
I'm going to ask Mr. Cunningham to speak a little bit. Parkway Avenue Elementary School today had a Veterans Day celebration, and Mr. Cunningham was able to attend that.
Okay. Yes, thank you. As I guess she does annual, Ms. Herskowitz put together a Veterans Day ceremony that really speaks to the fact that schools not only teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, but also there's a citizenship component that I think sometimes we forget is there. And Parkway does an excellent job of providing that citizenship component. All the students at Parkway came outside around the flagpole and the peace pole. She had veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Iraqi conflict there, and along with some of our elected officials, and students sang songs. And then after the outside ceremony, the fourth and fifth graders went back into the building and spent time speaking to the veterans. So it was really well done, and I think it's important that we remember that we have to teach our children what Veterans Day is about and why we celebrate it.
POB Middle School is doing a Veterans Day tea tomorrow, which is similar to the event that was held at Parkway today. And I've attended the portion of it where the students sit down with the veterans, and it's done in small groups. It's fourth graders, yeah, but in small groups. And when the students have an opportunity to ask questions that they've pre-prepared to inquire about their experiences, it's very moving, and it becomes very real to the students having the veterans there. Again, I applaud that school for really doing this year after year, because every group of fourth graders really gets that one-on-one experience. I'd also just like to give a shout out. On Thursday night, we have our second annual family night, where there will be no district events after 5 p.m., and that includes sporting events so that our families can spend time together. That means no homework. No homework. Did I say that? No homework on Thursday night. So again, there are some local businesses that have provided some discounts. There was an e-blast that was sent out with regard to those discounts, but we hope that people find the evening enjoyable and take the opportunity to spend it with your children uninterrupted.
I think we missed one board announcement. Emily?
Yes. Tomorrow night at, I believe, Matlin Middle School, there will be SEPTA Night Out, the annual fundraiser, and I look forward to it. Hope people come out for it. It should be very successful then. It always is. And it's their only fundraiser and helps raise money for scholarships and other good things.
Okay, we're going to get to reports and discussions. We have our architects here to present on the bond update, so we're going to push 3.3 to the front of the class. Can you guys, Rich and the architects, you can start.
I want to use use a mic to record.
I think the board remembers Steve Walsh. He's our lead architect from BBS on our projects. We meet at least once a month and speak a lot more often on the phone. So with that, Mr. Walsh will give us a little bit of a retrospect of where we've been, but also, more importantly, where we're going in the next year and a half.
Thank you, Rich. Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Walsh from BBS Architects. And if I haven't seen you in about 6 months, it's been because we've been pretty busy. We had a really busy summer. The guys from School Construction Consultants in the back, I got to give a reach out to Will and to Bob. They've been at every meeting with us every month with the school district. And what we've done over this summer, as everyone is aware, is we concentrated on trying to get your envelopes in some decent shape, to get your roofing back in order, and also to do some of your interior work. I don't think that's a working. There we go. So back in December 9th of 2014, it feels like a long time ago, but it's actually less than a year, the bond was approved, and we thank the public for that. And what we've done is, ever since then, every month, as Rich has stated, we've had an owner, architect, and CM meeting to prioritize the initial projects and to firm up scopes. Then there was a typical process of submissions to SED facilities planning and then bidding and construction. So we'd have interim meetings to discuss the project scopes, and we had proposed bundling to expedite review at the state, which is a very precarious process these days because, as of right now, the review time at the state for any mechanical, electrical, plumbing-based projects is between 42 and 46 weeks. So after we've had our projects go out to bid, we have pre-bid, we have pre-bid walkthroughs. We'd have them attended by potential bidders. BBS, the district, and SEC would attend. And then we'd have prove-out meetings after we took our lowest responsible bidders to make sure that they could meet the requirements of the contract documents, and we could expedite vetting out the process. So we wouldn't have contractors that came in that said they could do one thing and would wind up doing something else. So as you're aware, the summer projects that we had this past 2015, these were all designed immediately after the bond referendum passed. The required paperwork was prepared and submitted to the district, and the project was then submitted to SED. I think it was 2-6. It might have been a little earlier than that, but basically within a month and a half to 2 months of the bond hitting. And those were all the projects that we knew the state would be able to expedite review on because they didn't have any mechanical, electrical, plumbing involved. They were mostly general construction-based or they were site-based. So in that time period, what we did over this past summer is the site improvements at JFK, which are the two new and the four reconditioned tennis courts, the site improvements at POB Middle School, which was the new backstop, the site improvements at Matlin, which was six new tennis courts, the site improvements at Pasadena, which was the replacement of the RPZ retaining wall, site improvements at Stratford, which include a ball field renovation, and then roof rehabilitations at Matlin, Old Bethpage, Pasadena, and at Stratford. Floor abatements were done this summer also at JFK High School, POB Middle, Matlin, the A wing only, the B, C, and D are going to continue next summer, Parkway at Pasadena and Old Bethpage, Stratford and the balance of Matlin will be done next summer. There was just too much to be done. And these phase one projects received SED architectural review and approval, projects were bid, and we opened up September of 2015 without missing a step. Here are your new courts. You guys have seen all these already. I don't really need to dwell on old. I'm going to go to some of the new. There's the walking track. That was a project that we really wanted to get done. That was a capital transfer project from last year. That got done. The other project that was complementary to it are the boilers at Matlin, and those are bidding tomorrow. Okay. Roof restorations at Matlin, flooring at JFK. Yes, it's an SPF foam roof. All those roofs that got rehabilitated got new 15-year warranties on them.
And that foam
Absolutely.
And then it lets it cool out.
Lets it cool out, yep. And we just closed the projects out, I think, for all four of them. I just handed Mr. Ward all of the paperwork. You got your warranties right by his feet. So we had flooring replacements at Old Beth, and we had flooring replacements at Parkway. So what are the next steps? What's moving forward? What are we going to do for summer of 2016? So these following projects are currently active and on the boards, and we project them for summer 2016 construction released to bid or sooner. Window replacements at POB Middle in Jamaica. Those are actually out to bid right now. They got their SED approval, the bids are due on November 13th. Interior doors and hardware replacements at Pasadena Parkway in Jamaica. They're currently under SED review. An addendum has been sent up to the state. We expect permit issuance very soon, and we'll bid them as soon as the permits are available. And then we're going to have follow-up projects for interior doors and hardware at Matlin and POB Middle School. Those were sent up. The paperwork was sent up on November 2nd, and we expect the SED review within 8 to 12 weeks thereafter. And then the interior doors and hardware at Stratford, the high school, Old Beth Page, and Fern are all in design right now. We're going to be handing the paperwork off to the district pretty soon for some signatures, and we should get those. We'll have all of the doors and hardware projects, because it's an 8 to 12-week review period. We're going to have all those underway throughout the spring. And what that'll do is it'll allow the district at a certain point, when we have our building permits, we can actually purchase some of the hardware on state contract to save some money, and you'll be able to start putting all of the security lock sets on the rooms immediately, as soon as those permits are in place. And the last line we can strike off, still awaiting SED approval on Parkway and Pasadena window replacements. We got the building permits last Thursday. So those are going to go out to bid in the next week or two. The following projects are currently in design with a projected fall to early winter of 2016 submission to SED. Ceilings and lightings improvement at all the schools. I won't go into them all, but basically they're all designed. We're waiting for the test data to come back from J.C. Broderick, whether we know we have positive or negative asbestos content in those projects. Once we get those, we already have the paperwork back, we'll be able to submit them to state ed. Auditorium, LGI, and cafetorium improvements. All the listed schools are going to be having, the architectural scopes are drawn. We've met as a group, like Richard said, we meet once a month. And when we meet as a group, what we do is we talk about what scope do we have to apply to the projects, what monies do we have available. And we've had our theatrical consultants, Barbizon, come out and actually give a nice little scope to select from. Here are the items we found. Aside from what you had, would you rather do this over that? So it's going to be a back and forth between the director of fine arts and where he wants to, what he wants to apply. We have some additional funding, which is great, so some of the numbers come in lower than what we'd expect. So we'll be able to basically enlarge the scopes within our same budgets. And then we have various mechanical upgrade projects at Stratford Road, POB Middle, Matlin, and Parkway. They're all in design, and what those constitute is isolated stuff, maybe some ventilation issues, or it may be some smoke and a fire alarm issues, just localized projects that need to get done that are going to get their building review over the winter. And we're right now in the middle of working on the ADA toilet improvements at all the listed schools. They're currently in design. We expect to have them up to the state before the end of the year. Addressing health and safety, we have the boiler and burner replacements at HB Matlin. That was a fund transfer project from last year, has its permit, and it's currently bidding. It's due on the 13th. Window and exterior door replacements at POB Middle and localized window replacements at Jamaica Avenue, currently bidding. They're going to be due over the next week. We'll be taking the bids. We'll be able to process those and vet out the contractors before the holidays. Roof rehabilitation at JFK High School was another project that was added into the mix. Is it also a fund transfer project? That's about 50% design right now, but that'll be an easy review also at the state because it's single trade. It's general construction only. Window replacement at Parkway in Pasadena. Like I said, cross that off. We've got our permit. We're putting that out to bid over the next week or two. And then the cluster of interior doors and hardware. So that's really going to be the scope of what goes on between now and summer of 2016. Current projects in design. I made these green, and it wasn't a mistake. It's because these projects are the ones that start dipping into the mechanical, electrical, and the plumbing issues, so they're going to take a little longer at the state to get reviewed and approved. But mechanical upgrade projects at POB Middle is to refurbish the automatic temperature control system, exhaust fans, day-night system, to balance the heat in the building. Pool dehumidification, conduct mechanical upgrades to the heating plant, including the B&G and offices. Mechanical design is completed. We're in electrical design right now. Matlin, we have the refurbishment of the automatic temperature control system and the energy management systems. Mechanical design is completed. It's in electrical design now. Stratford Road, building to provide the new building-wide energy management system, refurbish ATC, the exhaust fans, into day-night system. Mechanical is scheduled to complete by the end of this month, and then we'll put it into electrical. And then at Parkway is refurbishment of unit ventilators, refurbish the gym H&V systems, provide relief air paths to selected rooms, provide building-wide energy management, refurbish the existing ATC system, tie exhaust to day-night system, provide additional ventilation to the cafeteria, similar to what was done at Old Bethpage. Mechanical design is underway, and one of my electrical designers was over at the school today, so he's just started electrical for that. So the common thread to each of these aforementioned projects is mechanical, electrical, and plumbing. I'm not saying this specific to this district. I actually used the same presentation 2 weeks ago in Islip. The entire state is this way right now. Any of these projects that include mechanical, plumbing, and or electrical design has a review period, I want to say, of 8 to 10 weeks for architectural, first at the state, and right now, when it goes into mechanical, electrical, plumbing, it's listed as 40 to 42 weeks. So these projects that I just listed in the green text should be considered 2017 because they're a little ways off, but we're still going to have our hands full, and we're still going to keep SCC busy for the summer of 2016. And that will do it unless anybody has any questions.
Thank you very much. Things are going on schedule, and thank you very much, guys. Keep up the good work. Absolutely, they should be. Oh, they're not anymore. Oh, we're in under construction of the redoing the boardroom. I apologize for that. All right, next on the agenda, we're now at 3.1, grading committee recommendation, Board of Education. If you recall, earlier in the year, we had several people come up, parents, and with concerns about various different gradings that had gone on with Common Core algebra, with college credits, with Regents weighting, with the fact that we had snow days, so we couldn't get the midterms in, so we appointed a committee to look into this project for us and give us a recommendation. The committee was made up of parents, teachers, administrators. I think they're all going to be introduced, or it's on a slide to follow, but here we go, the grading committee recommendations.
I'm going to invite Mr. Murray and Lori Lynn up to the microphone. They were the co-chairs of the committee. But Mr. Patan, I'd just like to reiterate that the committee was made up of all three groups of administrators, teachers, and parents, and I have to say this was, of all the committees that I've sat on recently, this was a very healthy discussion and a really nice exchange of ideas, and the committee was certainly respectful of the opinions of one another, but again, I want to thank everyone for their participation and their very thoughtful responses. We have recommendations for you this evening, but know that we met over 4 dates, and I'm going to have Mr. Murray really and Lori Lynn dig into that a little bit further. But thank you to the two co-chairs of the committee as well.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for that introduction. We greatly appreciate it. Ms. Girosh was mentioning. Like Ms. Girosh was mentioning, it really was a pleasure working on this committee with all of these professionals. It was a group of 18 teachers, parents, and administrators working for the common goals that Ms. Lynn is going to address in a moment. But I would just like to, of course, take a moment just to acknowledge all of the members of this committee.
I don't know what I did. Sorry. Sorry about that.
I don't know what you did.
So while that's being brought up, there were five basic topics. Thank you. Which one am I using? Five topics that the committee.
Wait, just hold the microphone up. Can you pick up the microphone? When
sure. Sure.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. We can go back. Okay. So there were five topics that the committee reviewed. First was regions weighting, really midterm and regions weighting in terms of within the calculation of a course grade, the algebra results from 2014-2015, the midterm weighting for geometry and U.S. history in 2014-15, midterm weighting in the case when no exam is given, and the weighting of the college-affiliated courses. Okay, so the first topic was the midterm and regions final exam weighting. To review the talking points, the mid-year exam has always been counted for 7% of a student's average. Regions and final exams have always counted for 13% of a student's average. We compared our district's midterm and region's final exam grade weighting with several other districts. Many of those districts had the listed the regions as counting for 20%, the midterm being folded into their quarterly grades. And we discussed the level of importance of major exams versus effort and learning in the classroom. The recommendation from the committee was consistent with our current practice, and no changes were recommended regarding the weight given for midterms and regents or final exams.
Thank you. Can you change the slide, please? Thank you. Next thing we talked about were the algebra results from the 2014-15 school year. The reason why we took a look at that is there were some school districts, neighboring districts, that did something different that year. They still administered the old version, where we felt our students were ready, and they took the Common Core Regents exam. We looked at our results and the data that we had from how the students were performing in class, and compared that to how they did overall on the exam, and the point differential was really negligible. So the teachers that were on the committee were also teachers of the course that were involved with reviewing the data, and they felt very comfortable about the exam, that it was an exam that was reflective of what they taught in the classroom, which was really, I think, really very reassuring for the committee that we did the right thing. And that our students were not hurt by it, which is really one of the things that we were examining, of course, to make sure that our students weren't hurt by the decision being made. We also took a look at the midterm weighting for geometry and U.S. history during the 2014-15 school year. The reason why we took a look at those two classes, if you have your memory intact from last year, we had the snowstorms that repeatedly happened to us, and we kept on rescheduling those two exams until we got to the point where we were out of days, and it was either we take instructional days away, upon our return to school, or we just forego the midterm exam or try to do them in class. We opted to do what we did during the time of Hurricane Sandy, where in that year we didn't administer any midterm exams. In this case here, of course, we did except for those two. But that year, as well as with these two exams, we ended up not having the midterm exam and taking the final exam, or in this case, Regents exams, and counting them as 20%. The reason why we made that decision is because we know our data. We know how our students perform on midterm exams versus how they do on Regents exams. And we felt that our students would not be hurt by it, because traditionally our students outperform on the Regents exam their results from midterm exams. We were, of course, not very happy that we weren't able to administer the midterms that year, because we were lacking a diagnostic, something that is helpful for students as well as for the teachers, because that's something that can guide instruction as the rest of the year goes on. But what they did in place of having that was they used the questions from the midterms that were not administered in their classes to be able to verify whether or not they needed to go back over certain topics to help their students. So in the end, it ended up working out okay. The results, of course, we looked at that, and our students did very well. They were not recommending any changes once again.
Along the same lines, the committee discussed what should be done in the case, in those hopefully rare times when midterms are not able to be given. Again, talking points, concerns were raised about the loss of more instructional time for the sake of making up exams. We discussed the fact that attempts will be made to make up canceled exams during that testing week. No more than two class periods will be allotted for makeups. It was also a suggestion that when designing midterms, teachers may want to identify questions that can easily be removed if a modified in-class version can be administered, as opposed to creating an additional testing day. The recommendation of the committee, when there is no final exam for a half-year course, would be to count each marking period for 50% of the grade. When there's no midterm or final for a full-year course, to count each marking period for 25% of that course grade. When a midterm cannot be administered or rescheduled, 7% midterm values should be divided equally, resulting in 1.75% among all four marking periods, giving each a 21.75% value, with 13% remaining for the final exam.
And the final point, thank you. We talked about the college course weighting. Currently, our practice is for honors level courses, they would receive a 5% weighting at the end of the course. And traditionally, of course, with our AP courses, they would receive a 7% weighting. We discussed that, and we felt that percentage is appropriate, did not need to be changed. In addition to that, we also looked at our college level courses. And, in the fact that those courses are very challenging courses as well, but don't receive a weighting at all. And we discussed whether or not they should. Our committee agreed that they do deserve to have a weighting. But we went back and forth in our discussion on should it be 5%, should it be 7%, should it be somewhere in the middle at 6%. We ended up agreeing that it should be 5%, the same as the honors level weighting. We reconvened one last time to discuss when that should actually take place. And it would be our recommendation that the college-level courses should, all of them, not one in particular, but all of the courses should go into effect for this current school year. And we really spent a lot of time just to make sure transcript-wise, if that was something that would be a red flag or anything like that that would cause attention to our students in a negative light at this point in time in the year as they're applying for colleges. But we do not believe that it would be. In fact, it would be something that would be advantageous for them. In most cases, anyway, with colleges, they remove the weighting for them. But when it comes down to, at this point, choosing the valedictorian, salutatorian, anything like that, it could be useful information. So that is pretty much it from the work that our committee did. I mean, like I said, there was a lot of different things that we discussed over the four meetings that we had, but it was a great opportunity to work and hear each other's thoughts and come to some consensus. Thank you very much for giving us this charge. Do you have any questions?
Questions, Emily?
You said the difference is for the
the algebra?
Yeah, that the it was fairly negligible. I'm wondering if you could quantify that for us.
Yeah, it was what, less than a point.
0.68.
Okay. In terms of overall average?
Yes.
If you were to remove that exam, it would be 0.68. That okay.
So, you're recommending that this year we apply the weighting of 5% to the college level courses.
That would be correct. Yes.
I just had a follow up. I'm sorry.
No, go
ahead. As part of this, what I'd like to ask that we could do is review all our college level courses and just make sure we are delivering the college level product that we're saying they all are, and if not, to review, you know, the schools that we're affiliating with those programs, if they're not delivering what we think they should. And I only bring that up because I know there's areas where kids have gotten college credit for courses, and then when taking a proficiency class test in order to get that actual credit, the results haven't been that's spectacular. So I just like us to look at it. I don't know what's good or bad. That's not for me to say. But if you guys could do that review, I'd appreciate it.
You know, we don't get that kind of data on how they do that when they take those type of exams. So that would be good information if we could only get that. But I agree with you. And part of right now what we are working on is not only our new course proposals for next year, but also our modifications or tweaks, as they're commonly refer to them here, and that is part of the process as well, is looking at any of them to see if we have any recommendations for changes, and of course curriculum writing that could take place over the summer.
Debbie?
When you were discussing with the committee the change in weighting for the college level courses, was the committee's decision based on them believing that the college courses are taught at the same level as honors as opposed to AP? I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what the thought process was there.
Well, I think there was a consensus that there definitely is a difference between the AP level courses, the requirements of AP, the pace of an AP course as compared to the college level courses, which is why the agreement was that it shouldn't be up to the 7% level as an AP course.
And if I could also add, in the AP course, if you choose not to take the exam, you'll lose the AP designation. You know, the distinction that's on your transcript and whatnot, we'd have to notify the schools that you applied to. It's really big. You must take that. But in majority of our college-level courses, that is not a requirement that you would have to take that exam for it, or it may not be just one exam.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Is there information for some of the college-level courses for parents who might want to know which schools give credit for it going forward? How is that readily available to families who might be deciding between courses?
I don't know that it's, that's so fluid. Colleges can change their minds year to year. We can take a look at, you know, historically where colleges have accepted, but I would hesitate to use that as any kind of a guarantee, because that can always change.
The only reason I was wondering was, I know for advanced placement, for example, you can go online and find that out pretty readily which schools will take which exams, and I gather that's not the case for some of these other courses.
Correct.
Well, Lori, am I correct that in some instances where the college may accept the credit for one child in a particular area, but if they have a specific major, I believe that they might not take it for the child's major, where in fact they can use it as an elective credit. On the other hand, for some, if they're in a different major where that course, they might actually accept it. So
right. Or for placement purposes, they may not accept the credit or use it for placement.
So I think the answer isn't as cut and dry as we'd like it to be in some instances. But that we do have, you know, when we were making some of the decisions, some historical information about acceptance.
And just if I could, if we have any of the parents or teachers or staff members who participated on the committee, if you could just stand up so we could thank you for your time and what you put into it. Thank you very much.
Again, we each group that represented the committee, we asked them to go back and forth between meetings with their constituency groups. But again, I would ask that the board hold off on making any decisions until there's some public response to this going forward.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have... And Jim and Lori, thank you. Great job presenting on it as well. Thank you very much. Next, we have LICE protocol. Oh, wait. No, we have the school board report, law conference. And we're also going to give some little updates on some of the things we saw at the board. So the law conference is, who's going to go first on that? Okay. Knock off what we can.
Debbie and I attended the law conference, so I'll just take like a little bit of it. Part of it was negotiations and what is the current trend. There was bullying in the workplace, talking about what happens when adults are being bullied in a situation, how it should be handled. And a theme that was quite a few workshops, talking about students who are transgender. And what rights does a child have when they come into a building? What should a school district do to prepare for children who are, whether they're transgendered or they are in a transition state? School should have a bathroom available if that child chooses to use a freestanding bathroom. But it is up to the student where they want to change and what bathroom they want to use. The young man who spoke to us called himself a trans man, as he said that was the preferential way to be deferred to. It's also the pronoun to be used is they. Students must never be outed out for what they do. There are some students who come into a building and will change into a different clothing, put makeup on, or change whatever they want to do. It is up to the school to keep that child's confidentiality if he or she does not want it outside of the school to be known. The most important thing is to remember that the Civil Rights Act protects children. The First Amendment says, among other things, the First Amendment protects students' rights to free speech and freedom of expression, including the expression of gender identity. And it's very, very important because now we're starting to see students as young as second grade who are beginning to transition, how schools have to adapt to it. And I just happened to teach a DASA course on this, and one of the things, I had a student raise their hand and say that as a teacher, she has the girls line up and the boys line up. From now on, it's everybody lines up together, and it should also not be by height, because that's a form of discrimination. It should really be alphabetical, whatever you want, and always mix the lines around. It's just one of those things we have to become aware of. But the most important thing is that when a child, and I have to say something about our school district, because we have had children go through who have been transgendered students, they are accepted, they are treated with dignity, exactly the way he or she wants to be treated. And as much as this is a phenomena and it's a hard thing, it's discussions we have to have, but it's the rights of that individual person and how we treat them. Field tests now have three boxes, girl, boy, other, which is something we really should be discussing because that other box is inappropriate, especially for very young children, throws them off. They don't know what they're supposed to do or how to answer it. We should be talking to students about it. We should be providing a student with whatever support system they need, because children who are transgender students have one of the highest rates of suicide out there. So it's very interesting, and, you know, I'll get this for the school so you all get copies of it, the new laws and everything, but it's evolving, and as students are beginning to become freer to talk about it, it is their choice, and it's who they want to be, and that's how they have to be respected.
Ginger, I think we've kind of discussed it, but a recommendation will be made to...
We should have policies
policy
also.
Sciasis,
yeah, Sciasis policy. I'm not sure if it's online yet. I was going to go check it today.
Until the end of November.
Yeah, Sciasis has a policy that they are just in a rough state with. I've spoken to some other school board members in other districts. They have not done anything, but it's something that is the right of a student. We have to address it, and we'll work with legal counsel, I guess, to get the right wording and seeing what's out there, because there must be some policies already out.
As soon as we can and keep it prudent.
Yeah.
Great. Other updates from the board and convention. Lauren?
So I apologize, I was not at the last board meeting, so I apologize if I'm a little repetitious. I was honored to be chosen to be at a POB delegate at the 2015 convention, and for the board to entrust me with this position, especially, I want to give a thank out for the sideline cheering. Yeah. I did. I had the best cheering section around. So the board receives a newspaper entitled On Board, and in it mentioned our amendment resolution, so yay. It was widely received, but unfortunately our district's name was not mentioned. So I actually was approached by other districts like Ardsley and even Lake George congratulating us on such a well-written amendment and offering to partner with us in any future resolutions that we had. They were so impressed. So it was clear that other districts as well believed, as we do, that we don't have a lot of confidence in the testing system and that something's just not working. The amendment in Proposition 3 had a very active discussion among the board delegates, and we lost that one in a close vote. I think the wording about APBR and future negotiations led to it not passing. Surprisingly, many school boards did not even vote on Proposition 25. I believe it was due to the words opt out. Even after I tried to explain that we really meant basically giving parents a right of choice whether a child can take a test or not, and putting a legal burden on a district board, our administration, our teachers. I also noticed a lot of districts had a copycat mentality, which really bothered me the most. I sat there with my, you know, everybody gets this paddle. Very cool. And I would look over at other board members, and as soon as you're supposed to raise the paddle, I saw a lot of this. And it bothered me so much, because you really should be voting, if not with your board members, as discussions as we have in an open forum, but with your head and your heart for the best interest of students and your district. And it just bothered me. What I respect so much about our district is that we discuss the resolutions prior to going into this. So, sorry. I knew what all our members felt about each resolution. I don't think each district is as transparent with their boards or public as I spoke with some of them. We are quite fortunate here. In all, the 229 delegates passed 19 resolutions, which became part of NISBA's 2016 advocacy agenda and stay in effect as official positions for the next 5 years. All in all, the most important thing I came away with was that over 200 people representing all different districts are all in one room for the same reasons to together fix these problems and get things moving in the right direction for the future of students.
You did a great job, Lauren. We were all
very
proud of you.
Thank you. Okay, who's next for the next time? Not me.
One of the more interesting sessions I attended was titled "How to Use Digital Games to Engage and Motivate Your Students." The speaker was Robert Sun, who the inventor of First in Math and is the chairman, president, and CEO of Suntex International. I'm going to highlight just three of the things. He spoke for a little over an hour, so I'm just going to highlight three of the many things that he said I thought were interesting, generating some discussion among those that were listening. The first is he discussed how digital gaming can help to change a learner's identity in a positive way. And that was the focus, essentially, of his speech. He said he describes that in order to change a learner's identity, you have to focus on three things, three steps. One, you have to encourage a student to try. Two, the student has to put in effort. And three, you have to achieve some meaningful success if you want to continue and sustain the process. He described how digital gaming does this in the following ways. There are multiple points of entry. You jump in without worrying about failing. There are clear short-term objectives with immediate feedback. You encourage the child to take ownership, allowing them to control, let them make the decisions about where to go and what to do. And he highlighted his view that he thinks that's part of the problem in education today. We're not allowing the kids to try and having multiple points of entry and fail and learn by failing. The second highlight is he focused on the difference between knowing, which is the conceptual understanding that's up to the trainers, the teachers, the educators to help with, and the doing, which is the practice part of what students have to do and that the educators facilitate. And he focused on math and algebra in particular. And he describes math and saying that math isn't duplicating what we do in sports and music, which is what a lot of parents focus on, sports and music. They say in sports and music, we spend about this much time teaching the basic concepts, but then throughout the course of a week or month or a season, we spend this much time practicing. Whereas in math, we may spend this much time learning and this much time practicing. And in his view, we don't give students enough time to practice, to make the mistakes, to learn from it, to truly become proficient, which led into a third point that he made, which was something I thought was interesting. Is he challenged the idea, at least took a different approach, the idea that, for those of you that read the Malcolm Gladwell book Outliers, in Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell describes that in order to master something, to become truly proficient in something, you need to put in approximately 10,000 hours into a certain activity. He talked instead about deep practice and not about the 10,000 hours. Instead, that occurs when a child makes the internal decision, I want to do something. I want to get better at this. I want to learn this. This is what I want to do when I get older. And instead of spending, it's not about the amount of time you spend, but it's about the quality of the time, the energy that you put into it. And in his view, 6 minutes of what he referred to as deep practice could actually be better than 3 hours of non-deep practice. And he got into the science of neurology associated with it. And quite frankly, I understood it when he was explaining to me, and I certainly cannot do a service to how that works, but how the deep practice really mattered. And when you get a child interested and excited about a subject, whether it's math or something else, it's the time that they focus on that that's going to help them generate proficiency and mastery in it. And so here's my takeaways from that. We've been ratcheting up challenges probably for decades, but every year, particularly recently, we've been ratcheting up challenges. We've setting higher expectations for our children, which isn't a bad thing. But if we're going to set up the higher expectations, then we have to give students the skills to meet those challenges, and we need to give the educators the training and the resources to deliver the instruction. And it seems like we're rushing that. We're not giving them the resources. We're not giving the students the skills, and they all kind of interrelate. And so our focus should not be on compliance, simply compliance. Our focus should be on creating lifelong learners, and that doesn't happen overnight. It happens over time. How do we engage and motivate students to learn? According to Robert Sun, digital gaming may be one of those answers. Clearly he has a company that does that, so he's pushing for that. But at least for some students, it may be worth exploring. It gives students the freedom to make mistakes. It challenges them. It encourages them to build on what they learn. Short-term goals lead to bigger ones. Two facts that I thought were worth noting. One, we now collectively spend in the world 3.5 billion hours a week on video gaming. 3.5 billion hours. And the average age of someone that's engaged in video gaming is 29 and 30 years old. Not 14 or 15 on their Xbox, but 29 or 30 years old. So if it works for us, I'm not saying it always does, but to the extent it does, perhaps it also works for our kids. Perhaps it's something to continue to explore, or at least some of the concepts that he outlined, whether it's in math, social studies, or science, something to consider. So I thought it was an engaging conversation.
Okay, so some of the comments that you just made about kids trying and the mindset relates to some of our goals this year about teaching kids that it's okay to make those mistakes. And I actually did a walkthrough of one of the schools today, and this was a bulletin board up on the wall. Change your words, change your mind. So a statement that's hanging is, this is too hard. Instead, this may take some time and effort. I made a mistake. Mistakes help me improve. I'm not good at this. I'm on the right track. I give up. I'll use some of those strategies I've learned. And although these are words and there's more to this up on the wall, what I saw in the classrooms today, whether it be in the music classroom where the students had their violin out, or in the math class where they had their whiteboards or manipulatives, it was about every class I walked in, it was about asking kids to try. It's okay to make mistakes. And I could not, this is really practicing what you preach, because there are words up on a wall, but unless you hear those teachers encouraging it, but to know that it translates to what's going on in our schools. And I think if you walk in some of our schools, particularly our elementary schools, that you're not seeing completed bulletin boards anymore of finished work. You're seeing process boards. And where we expected student work to be hung that was completed from beginning to end, you're seeing work in progress. And again, that's encouraging the process rather than the product and celebrating the learning.
I'm actually not going to do my report, but I just wanted to spiral off of that, because just as somebody who used to teach writing, one of my favorite things I used to tell students is writing is rewriting. And I think so many people have this idea that there's this platonic paper that just sort of comes out if you're a really good writer. And I think the earlier people get the idea that it is ultimately a process and that things get better. Not that it's supposed to come out perfectly if you're naturally good at something. You know, I think that's a really actually powerful lesson. So.
Jody, you have some updates?
Okay. Well, I'll do the Cuomo meeting first, since that one's a little bit longer. I was in.
A really important conversation. If you could take it outside, that'd be great. Otherwise, it's very distracting. Thank you.
Okay. I was invited to a meeting with Tim Kramer, who is the NISBA director, who's sitting on Cuomo's Common Core panel. The meeting was made up of about 11 or 12 districts, trustees with views that don't necessarily align with those of the Common Core Task Force. And the goal was, since most of the Common Core Task Force seems to be made up of people who are very supportive of the standards, and there's not really a single critic on the task force, was just to express some concerns to Mr. Kramer in the hopes that he would at least throw them on the table for discussion among the task force. And I'm not going to go over what was discussed, because I think it's, you know, stuff we've all heard over and over and over again. I just wanted to bring up a couple of concerns. At the time of our meeting with Mr. Kramer, the task force had had one closed meeting that was on October 16th. And one of the things that the task force themselves expressed some concern about was that Governor Cuomo is pushing for a full set of recommendations in time for his State of the State address. And anybody who's gone on and seen that survey knows, you know, there's a lot to go through. There's a lot to consider. There's a lot to discuss. And even the task force themselves are concerned that there really isn't enough time to have meaningful discussion and make meaningful change in that time frame. And that, for many of the people who were at the meeting, calls into question how serious this is. Is this really just for show? Or, you know, if meaningful change is the goal, more time is definitely required. And that's really it. You know, so since that our meeting with Mr. Kramer, there have been subsequent meetings of the task force. On the 29th, there was a meeting of the task force where no public participation was allowed. There were several presenters, Lisa Rudley from NYSAPE and Jamal Brown, who is the founder of the Cornerstone Academy for Social Action Middle School in the Bronx. And there was one other superintendent. It might have been Sleepy Hollow. And they were allowed to present their concerns regarding Common Core to the task force. The one thing that, if anybody who's, I don't know if anybody's watched the video I did, I watched that entire meeting, a couple of things did come out. Obviously, they're not really focused, the committee is not focused on testing or APPR. This is strictly about the standards. Some changes to testing may come about in terms of content, but they're really not talking about testing frequency. They're not talking about linking. This is really just about the Common Core standards. The one thing that stood out to me at the meeting was after Mr. Brown and Ms. Rudley presented was the task force started bombarding them with questions about, show me the data that proves that this is not working, which to me sent up a huge red flag and just the flawed mindset of this whole thing is that it is not the responsibility of the parents and the schools to show that it's not working. It is the responsibility of the state to show us that it is. And I think we can all agree that they haven't really done that. Then we went on to the Friday's listening tours where there were 10 simultaneous meetings where parents were allowed to speak. You know, and we all kind of know how that went. The majority of the speakers were very critical of the standards. You know, there were a handful that got up and did speak in support of the standards, but the vast majority of those who did get up to speak, especially at the Long Island one, were very critical of the standards themselves. So we'll see what happens from there. The other thing was I did attend on Sunday the media and communications seminar, and the focus of the seminar was really on three things. The first one being how to get positive press coverage and make sure that your accomplishments and achievements as a district get out there so that the community and the surrounding communities see, you know, all the great things you're doing. The second part was how to use social media as a communication tool with the community to share information, to get information out there, to facilitate discussion. So I think that will probably lead to future discussions among the board. And the last one was how to promote good digital citizenship among your students, which I know that's something that we're focusing on this week in the schools is, you know, how to be responsible on social media and respectful of your peers and, you know, thinking about what you post beforehand. So I think that there are some, you know, takeaways from that conference that'll lead to future discussions among the board.
Are we all done with the conference? Okay.
So a couple of board meetings ago, I asked our legislative committee to help in writing our legislators to demand change for safety as well as for our staff, students, and community. As of now, the legislative committee drafted a resolution. It's also included five bills that Chuck Levine has introduced on gun control safety that we permeated into the resolution that I'll read in a moment. I've been reading into too many articles lately on this topic. Many of them mention the link of mental illness and gun control. Interestingly, in my findings, I just recently read in the Wall Street Journal that federal government has 122 programs that deal with mental health in one way or another, yet a person with a serious mental illness is 10 times as likely to be in a prison cell than a psychiatric bed. Kind of makes you think. I'm not a professional in this by any means. However, I'm reading a lot about these mass shootings. These shooters clearly have some type of psychological problems, which include mental illness. How are these people getting availability to these weapons? We need to do something about this. I printed a copy of a chart I found of an article to show 45 school shootings that took place this year alone, just to put things in black and white. I have them in public participation, and I handed them out to everybody tonight. Thank you, Jean. It breaks it down as to K-12 schools and college school shootings. It's quite eye-opening. I'd like to thank Jody and the entire legislative committee for moving forward so quickly with this resolution and would like any feedback from the board on anything they'd like to add or change.
Just, Lauren, before you read it, everyone hasn't gotten it yet, so we're going to have to get it, and then we'll discuss it.
Okay, so we'll read it next time.
But you're putting everybody on notice that it's coming.
Right, it's on its way.
We are actively pursuing that. There was one other session that I went to that I wanted to talk about, which was on upstate district that put STEAM labs in all of their schools throughout the district. I'm not suggesting we need to do this. We just put a bond in, and I understand that. But it was really cool how they done that. They set up their labs that each lab had this rock wall that was tied into the actual sedimentary rock of that area and what you could do so the kids could be looking for fossils or investigating what happened over time as tying into a STEAM activities. And the labs were these really state-of-the-art designed from the ground up for STEAM activities. And I just thought it was a very cool thing and something that maybe, you know, years down the road we can consider doing, or if there's open space in the future, you know, to put it in there. But it was nice to have a place where the kids could just work on projects like that, which are so hands-on, that aren't necessarily conducive to doing a standard classroom-type layout. Some of them might take multiple days or even weeks to accomplish whatever the STEAM projects were. So I just thought that was pretty cool. We might have some other updates from the convention, but we'll do those next week. Okay. All right. Next, we have an issue that's been bugging some of the people on the Board of Ed for months. The lice protocol for the district. Ms. Girash, who's going to present that? Is that?
Yes, so there's copies of the lice protocol out for the public. This has been a discussion by some of our board members. I know this is such an engaging topic, but let me just say that the reason this was brought up as a topic was the reportings of some inconsistencies on how lice was handled within our schools from one school to the next, whether some parents were notified that there was a number of cases of lice in some classrooms. Was the class notified? Was the grade notified? Was the whole school notified? So we turn this back to the nurses district-wide, K-12, to take a look at our lice protocol, I want to call it. It's not a policy, but it is a practice that we follow. And there were some inconsistencies from school to school in how things were handled. As a result, the nurses met over several periods to discuss really some process and procedures. And one of the things that I want to convey is that confidentiality was a really was a consideration in this, and that this is not a health risk at all. There are some CDC guidelines with regard to lice. The American Academy of Pediatrics does give some guidance to districts about how to handle lice. Children should not, they recommend that children actually not be excluded from school. On the other hand, it is a nuisance. A significant nuisance, I'm going to say, to families, and you know, a number of hours and financial costs can obviously come to families to rid their homes of the lice should it be contracted in their home. So again, we want to be sensitive to the families, but on the other hand, we want to be cognizant of not excluding children from school. So there's a fine line between doing that with regard to this protocol and what kind of notification goes out.
Just to be clear, we're not voting on this today. This is for us to start the discussion going, and we do welcome feedback from the community. Do any board members have any comments or thoughts on what's been put out there at this point? Seth?
So, look, this is a topic that I brought up before, and in large part, you know, it was about the inconsistent protocol. So I'm happy that at least having that, you know, those meetings has created a little consistency across the board. I do want to weigh in on at least one of the protocols. I acknowledge, and I have in the past, that lice is not a health hazard. It is a nuisance, a potentially costly one to many families. It's an annoyance. I'm also not suggesting that we have to revert back to an old protocol where everybody in September has to go through and the nurses have to check everyone's head, give, you know, two number two pencils, and they check your head. I remember when I was younger. I'm not suggesting that either. But I think we should try to take a slightly more proactive approach with regard to the notice that we give parents, so that the parents can be better armed and be a little bit more vigilant. One of the listed protocols is number 4. Letters will be sent home to parents if 4 or more students in any given class are known by the nurse to have lice. So a couple of things about that. One is, for every reported case, there are usually multiple unreported cases. And we know that it's not just in your class, but you're on bus with other children. It's in the schools. You know, they throw coats on top of each other. There's hats. And if a parent knows, you know, a lot of what we do is giving the community is to communicate out to the community what's going on, to arm the parent, for the parent to take steps it wants to and be armed with the information. And so waiting for 4 in a class, I think, is a little too much. I mean, personally, we send emails out. We have school messenger. We send emails out all the time. There's no reason why in a school they can't just send a quick, there's been a reported case of lice, or there's been at least 1 reported case of lice. Just be mindful. Here's the, you know, here are some ways to address it at home. I don't think that is a whole lot to ask. I'm not suggesting other than taking 2 minutes to type that quick email out. Quite frankly, I think parents would appreciate hearing it. We know that whenever there's one, I mean, here, under this policy, theoretically, you could have 5 different classes that have 2 or 3 in a class and no letters are going home. And yet you know that 10 kids in a building could have lice and there's no notice, until it shows up on social media that, oh, my God, there's lice, and what do you do? And Lice Tamers and all these other places are, you know, making a few bucks. I appreciate the effort that goes in. I'm glad that we have consistency. I just think waiting for 4 or more students in a single class, I think we should be a little bit more proactive in the approach that we take with regard to notice.
Okay, I'm going to avoid using the words nitpick, lousy, and pest in discussing this. Sorry. My one question about this, I don't disagree in principle with what you're saying. I guess I just wonder, even if you find out, how much of a difference is that really going to make in terms of what you do? Like, how much can you really... You might know, but I'm not really sure how many steps you can take from the home to prevent, I guess is what I'm wondering. Other than maybe telling your child not to share a hat or a brush, which presumably you should be telling anyway. So I guess I'm just wondering from a practical point of view, what difference that would make.
I think one is, I think parents don't focus on it until they hear about it as much. And so once they get it, they're going to remind their kids, don't throw your coats on there. Don't share the hats. Yes, that's one thing. The other thing is, you're going to check your kid's head. You know, you're going to actually take the steps of checking each of your children to make sure it's not there and be a little bit more vigilant in that regard once you know it's out there. So you're going to be more conscious, and you're going to hopefully catch it as early as possible. It's up to the parent to decide how they want to do it. But at least we've done our job to send the notice out to the parents. It's in the building. It's in the grade. And it's up to the parents to decide how they want to approach it.
Agree with Seth, and I guess I also remember when my kids were in elementary school, and you were informed if I don't know if it was 1 child or maybe 2 children. I did look at my daughter's hair more carefully for a conceivable period of time. And I do think it's information that would be of value to parents to have.
All right, so we'll just look at this, maybe kick back and see if we can trim up that notification.
I will definitely bring this back to the nurses and to the building principals, as they, you know, it's not just the nurse fielding calls. I will say that for public purposes, the nurses do feel very uncomfortable with reporting the cases. So I think this was somewhat of a compromise. In again, I think they're very concerned about confidentiality, kids missing school. But I recognize the amount of calls that we've been getting in over this issue.
Yeah. It just seems to me if a notification just went out that there's been a case of lice in the school, there's no name attached, nothing else attached to it. I mean,
you can say the grade so people aren't looking at what children are out that the next day.
Well, usually, you go home, you wash the kid's head, and they go to school the next day. So it's not like something else. It's just really, we're doing a lousy job of doing this right now. A little bit of humor. But I just think really and truly just sending out an email blast and saying there's a case of lice. And, you know, parents should be watching, especially when a kid is sitting there going like this, that it could be your kid that has it.
Okay, so I'm not here to even debate this issue, but, okay, so we send out an email saying that there's been a notification of a case of lice in school. At what point? I mean, we have a number of cases, like you said, that may go unreported, but we are aware of, and then we're sending out another one and another one and another one after each one is remedied. So can you?
I mean, look, in the last couple of years, it's usually like a period of time, like a couple of weeks or a month after camp ends, and there's a period of time where you hear, I mean, quite frankly, that's when the reported cases come. And so when you get the report, you put it out there and I'm not saying every single incident that happens, but I just don't. I think waiting for four. I don't have the perfect answer. I don't. But I'm not saying if you get one day and then the next day someone reports, and the next day you have to keep on sending an email. But once you get it's out there, people are going
to
take their steps. Well, you could avoid multiple emails if you just say there's been a reported case in the building, and then you're done for however long. I mean,
I would imagine
that's
good for a week.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not. You know,
maybe it's good for a week.
My point is, I just think not sending the information out and waiting until four in one class seems a little, yeah.
All right, you'll work on it.
Next, we have senior citizen exemption. Mr. Cunningham, you want to walk us through that?
Sure. In the spring of 2015, we started getting calls from some residents who had previously, at least two residents, who had previously received partial tax exemption. Senior citizens limited income, so they had a combined income of less than $30,000, and there's a sliding scale. And the thing that had changed in their life is that one of their own children had come back to home and had a school-age child who then started attending public school. So they filled out their annual tax exemption form, listed that they now had a child in the home and that the child was attending public school, and they found that they no longer qualified for the senior citizens limited income tax exemption. So they have asked the district to consider extending that exemption to seniors who are on limited income but do have a child or a grandchild actually residing in their home who's attending public school. At this point, there are six parcels in the district that would qualify for the senior citizens limited income exemption if we amended our policy on this. But this changes from year to year. So right now it's six. We don't know what that's going to look like in the next set of tax rolls in 2017. So with that, if there are questions.
So the two questions I have are, one, we're talking about just an exemption for those that would otherwise be qualified if they didn't have a child?
Yes.
And so to the extent we're talking about more than six, it's someone, a family with 60, who is age 65 and older that has a school-age child going forward, which, right?
Yes.
That's the only way that would change.
Yes.
And if we were to make this change, When would we have to do that to become effective? When?
In order to be in effect for the 2016-2017 school tax bills, we have to act by this December 31st, 2015.
Okay.
If we act after that, if the board chooses that way, then it would be for the 2017-2018 tax rolls. So we're essentially working a year in advance.
Rich, is this based on household income or the senior citizens income? And the reason I ask that is that I see two different cases here. You know, if a minor has been put into the grandparents' care because of tragedy, family discord, or whatever has gone on, that I view that differently than, well, the kids have moved into the parents' house and now there's two families, you know, living in the house. And does the law allow any kind of differentiation between those two things?
The application asks for all sources of income for all owners and owner spouses. So it's not asking for income from their, you know, other people who may be in the home.
Right.
Owner and their spouse.
So there would be no way to know, say, for example, if, you know, the children of the elderly couple moved into the house and were making $75,000, $80,000 a year with their child, you know, that there's no way to know that.
The application for the exemption doesn't ask.
And the application, this is the state. This isn't something we get to write ourselves, correct? This is just a form that we just choose to say we're participating in or not.
It's actually a Nassau County Department of Assessment form, but they're using the standard format given by New York State for the exemption.
You know, I know it's never easy to vote against something, especially when it involves senior citizens who can be on a limited or fixed income. It puts it in a tough spot. But also, this isn't a law where an exemption, when it benefits that person, everyone else in the community has to pick up the tab. It's not like they get this subsidized by the state or someplace else. So the county, I'm just going to weigh in here, and unfortunately I wish it could be differentiated between those two examples I gave, because I feel very strongly about one, which is, you know, the minor entrusted to the grandparents, whereas the situation of the kids moving into the family house, I think that's great and all that, but I don't think that's the purpose or why this exemption exists in any way, shape, or form, or its intent. So I can't support broadening this measure, because I just don't feel that there's any control over where that comes from, and I don't think it's fair that other people should pick up the burden for that.
Do we have any way of asking them to come in to verify that that is the only income in that family? Because otherwise, you know, everybody can come, and I agree with Gary. I mean, this is taxpayers' money that we're talking about picking up. The rest of the community is going to have to pay for it.
I think,
you know,
that's a question for legal counsel. However, the application is to the Nassau County Assessor's Office. It's not to the Plainview Old Bethpage Board of Education or
but
to the
to
superintendent.
But we have to be in support of it.
That decides whether or not we allow this, right?
But you the policy that you are approving would either you can't determine that, since the application does not include a report for other adults who may be living in the house, the exemption isn't written in such a way that we can pick and choose on an individual basis.
Well, I guess that's what the real query is, because mm-hmm. if the problem is we don't know if the parents are living there, if this is a custodialship or whatever else. No.
So, well, can I just say, I share all the same concerns that you have. At the same time, you know, the owner of the property is the 65 and older with an income of 37,000 under, and they're the ones that are then legally responsible to pay the taxes, not whoever may also be residing with them. And so, to the extent that there's a burden, the burden, in my view, is still on the one that has only $37,000. Income coming in. And so, you know, I don't want to make any presumptions about the reasons why other people may be living in there, but you know, the burden of the tax is still on the person that's not making it. And so I get the same concerns, and I agree with it.
It's a slippery slope.
And there's no way to verify. And if there was, you know, I certainly support that, but I also don't want to see the few people that this really have an impact. I mean, we're talking about it impacts everyone $3 to $4. I just,
who do
you know,
we find out as a legal guardian of the children? Who do we find out as a legal guardian of the children?
How do we find out?
Is that part of the form?
Just simply who resides in that house.
Who resides. And there's a question that asks, is there a child who lives in the house? Mm-hmm. And then if they answer yes, they're supposed to report what school they attend. If they fill in that they attend public school, then the exemption no longer applies. If they elect to have the child attend a private school, they still qualify for the exemption.
Private school. But, you know, I'm assuming that the reason that this exemption first went into place was because the senior citizens who had a lower income were no longer burdening the school district, I hate to use those words, with children coming into the school. So they had paid their taxes all these years and no longer had children in the school district. But if these people still have children in the school district, what about people who have a low income and live in the school district and still have to pay their taxes? So that's
I hate to be issue. I understand what Seth is saying about the, you know, the elderly, even if there's an adult child who's gainfully employed living in the home, you know, the burden on paying the taxes still falls on them. But I think we all know that if there's a gainfully employed adult living in the home, they are helping with expenses. They're helping. And if they're not, shame on those.
For the purposes of having the, you know, I bring it up for the purpose of having a discussion. I'm just saying, you know, we can't make assumptions on each individual basis. I get the concern. My gut feeling, you know, starting the conversation was very simply like, this makes sense, right? And then Gary brings up his point. Someone that's essentially trying to game the system, but I mean,
it's a very uncomfortable discussion to be having.
It is,
and I think for anybody sitting there, it's uncomfortable because I hate being a judge and a jury on someone's income and how somebody lives their life or not. And my own, you know, I guess our concern is double edged. I mean, if there is another family in it producing an income, that's one thing. If there isn't, and we're sitting here and we're talking about somebody with an income of that level, the taxes here would eat up 75%, 80% of what the income is. So, I mean, it's just a hard call. And can we just hold this and discuss and think about it?
We have no date that we have to act on right now. So we will get more feedback and more information and put this on a future agenda if we warrant to go in that direction. We're now coming to public participation. District policy number 1510.1 provides that persons wishing to make comments or raise questions shall 1, state their name and address, and 2, indicate on whose behalf they are speaking if a non-resident. The policy prohibits public discussion on matters relating to staff and students at which their reputation, privacy, or rights to due process, or those of others could be in some way violated. Remarks are limited to 3 minutes. I ask that when people come up that you please, if you're in the audience, be quiet and allow them to speak so that they can be heard without any back chatter. And I also ask that we all take into mind the initial reading I read about treating each other with respect, and we can disagree, and it doesn't mean we have to be nasty or condescending, and the floor is open, 3 minutes at a time.
I don't think that mic's on.
Loud, but
we're recording.
Good evening. My name is David Cohen. I reside at 25 Richard Court. First off, I want to say hello to Mr. Batan. We know each other from lacrosse. I've spoken to a few of you today, tried to talk to a few of you, and Mr. Cunningham. Interestingly enough, about 13 years ago, I walked into this building and I had an issue. I had a serious issue. I was in my yard. I bought my house. So now it's almost 13 years ago. I have a four-month-old. There is a dilapidated baseball field behind my house. It's a like a Down syndrome school. It's for kids that are challenged. So I didn't think it would really be a problem until Little League shows up, until adults my age, kids all different age, Sunday morning, violently cursing, I mean, to the nth, where they even shot up my house with a pellet gun prior to I owned it. The crowd it brought was ridiculous. The problem I had was when I'm sitting out there with my daughter sitting in a carriage, I'm enjoying my yard. I came from an apartment. And I hear this ball, it literally landed right near my foot. I took my daughter and I ran into the house, okay? I shouldn't have to live like that. On top of which, the volume of noise that it brings, the constant ping, ping, it almost you feel it in your spine. It just makes you nuts. I wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning. My wife, it caused such anxiety and such problems. You constantly, people just yelling and cursing and carrying and cursing. And behind my house, it becomes like an echo chamber. And it just is over and over, and nobody cares. So I had a conversation with Martin Brooks at the time, superintendent, now in Phillips. And I said, we have a problem. I had one of my neighbors who passed away, so his wife cannot make it tonight. She was going to be here, Mrs. Simone. A line drive hit his house several times, you know, damaged his property. This is hazardous. Baseball fields are not supposed to be near people's homes. So that brings me here today. And I do not oppose handicapped children. I'm the biggest advocate. My wife sitting there deals with special needs children. She's worked with emotionally disturbed children. You know, so it's near and dear. I do oppose a field of such sort where it's for plain view and outside community. It's going to bring hundreds of people. The volume, it's not appropriate spot. Behind my fence, 97 feet, as Richard had mentioned to me. 6:30 Friday morning, well, politically, on the election day, I had the fence put up, and then at 6:30 in the morning, I'm waking to all the sounds of all the construction. I ask this board right now, 13 years later, did we make a mistake again? Why are we doing this once again, and what is your thoughts?
The board will get back to you on that, but Rich, can you explain what this field is? Because it's for the people in the audience. This is not a standard baseball field by any stretch of the imagination.
The field that's being constructed is 97 to 100 feet away from the first baseline, is 97 to 100 feet away from the fence line. It is a turf field designed for mobility impaired children. It's 7,000 square feet. If you compare that to a standard regulation Little League field, the standard regulation field would be 45,000 square feet. And it's designed for children. The agreement we have with the town of Oyster Bay, it's not supposed to be permitted for standard Little League or T-ball. Its intended use is Challenger baseball.
And I believe the age group that it's approved for is under 12. Is that correct?
I'd have to go back and review the contract document to give you the
According to Alessia, it's 4 to 22 years old. So, you know,
4 to 22
in her statement,
age of the entire program, but this field is not for the major part of the program. They have two divisions, apparently.
I respect that, and that's why I said I'm not opposed. Right. This field has also been shopped for 2 years, and it's been opposed to by several times. Look, I'm not a fancy lawyer. I don't try to be one. I can hire one. I can find one. The reality is, why? Why would you want to make a mistake again where I can stand up here and say, hey, look, Mr. Baton, Mr. Garcio, we have a problem. I mean, do I have to live this way? And the other crazy thing, You guys talk about this LICE program. Fantastic. I got the notice. I get notice on everything. My neighbor, okay, she sold her house. Ready for this? I get a notice that she has a closet that was built 30 years ago, and the CO is not correct. Am I going to petition that? Huh. I don't even get any notice whatsoever needed to any of my neighbors of this field being built. I don't have time to sit at these meetings. 12, 13 years went by. Hey, you know, I should be notified. I don't think that was proper. I don't even know if that's legal. And now I stand before you, and I ask you, and I get the same thing and say, well, it's a challenger field, and this is what it is and what it is. Why would you want to make that same mistake again? And I'll ask it one more time, that Martin Brooks and Alan Phillips and at the time Larry Herzog went out there and said, this is dangerous. This is a public nuisance. It is a public nuisance where I am constantly going to not be able to enjoy my quality of life. Where you guys all said, don't do the homework on Thursday night. Let the families be families. Well, guess what? I'm going to be hearing ping, ping, and all this nonsense constantly. It is not fair. It is not right. And as a homeowner, and even Ginger Lieberman, you were on the board back then with Mountain Brooks, and I can pull all these records up. I sent you what I sent, the petition, to have this torn down. And you can understand why I'm upset, and I can say it's challenging, but it's going to bring everybody else in, maybe not the first week. And I feel bad for these children that are going to be there. You're also pumping them in so far in these wheelchairs. There's better sites. I asked the board also, will you reconsider and look for another site? Jamaica Avenue, even Michael O'Connor, who's director of baseball, has stated that was supposed to be the spot and is a better spot. You have a sump on one side, a school on another. The poor people could drive up in their vans, pull right up, full access, a few steps, and you're at the field. Why would you want to put it on some top of somebody's house? Could somebody please answer me?
I thank you, and someone will get back to you.
That's all the answer, Gary?
That's what we have today.
I mean, say something. This is outrageous.
Okay, I just want to explain something, okay? The way public... The fields are determined by permits. People have to get permits to use the fields that are on the school. The permits are only being offered to the Challenger program and for the Challenger program only. The field that's being built is not suitable for anything else except for maybe wiffle ball, to be honest with you. It's 71 feet from behind home plate to dead center field where the end of the turf is as a rectangle. I appreciate the feedback you guys are giving. To compare this to what was a Little League field used by adults and older children of aluminum bats and hard pitching and foul balls, it's just not what the Challenger baseball program is. I ask that you look into a little bit more about what that program is. There's some videos online you can watch of the kids playing and what's going on. That is not what this field is strictly being built for that program only. And those are the only people going to be given permits to use the field.
Good evening to the board. My name is Amit. I just bought the house last year, and you know when we were looking at houses, I'm a 21 Richard Court. I saw one house, 3 Pal Court, if I remember the address correctly, and there was a baseball field right in the back of it, and I did not buy that. Obvious reason, my son plays baseball, trains in trial baseball, I love the game. There is no issue with the field. The only issue is we get information on everything. At least the board should follow a democratic process. At least send a survey out to the homeowners. That's fair in us asking about it. At least get our opinion on it. You know, not like 6:30 morning on Friday construction starts. We get everybody here and in the school get notices about every little thing, right? I mean, let's be fair and honest to each other as citizens. And consider, at least we have a say as homeowners in the process. There are different locations the field could be there. When I look at these children, and it's right behind my house, the same fence, how will we provide them with the restroom facilities when they are playing out there for 4 hours in the field? There is a field right opposite that diagonally. That's also very far. The Jamaica Avenue location is very good for them because it's just few steps away. What I am requesting the board is just to consider You know, would it be right if you were living on that street and you had no way of finding out that a field would be constructed in your backyard? That's my request to the board. If you put us in our shoes, would you think that way? And I would appreciate if everybody of us puts us in our shoes and makes a decision, we'll definitely respect that.
Fern Place currently has a baseball field on it, has, as far as I know, for decades. The soccer program has been playing soccer on those fields, as far as I know, for over a decade on weekends, mornings, with a field coming, I believe, within probably 20 to 30 feet of the fence, not the 100 feet of the fence. So to say that you didn't know there were any sports or anything going on there isn't exactly...
No, the sports we are aware, front. The soccer is probably more than 100 feet. It's quite far.
That's not been there for decades. That field was moved because of me.
No, I'm not talking about the field that was along where you are. There is a field on the other side
of
Fern.
500 feet from my house because I had it moved with Martin Brooks.
So it's over a decade.
That's not over a decade. Well, yeah.
Well, you said it was 13 years ago or whatever, so it's over a decade. And soccer has been played there. I really appreciate where you guys are coming from. The town is the one who donated the field. The town went through the whole process of what people have to do. We've had discussions on it. It's been in our meetings.
Why aren't we sent a notice? That's what I'm upset about. Why can't we get involved in this?
There was nothing from the town at all.
It's horrible. That's not how the town should be. We hear about everything.
Thank you.
That's all you guys can say is thank you. I mean, it's just not appropriate. I mean, I think we should have a full-on re-vote on this thing. I'm serious, Rat Gary. I mean, it's just not right. I mean, I know even Lorna Lewis is not here, and she represents. I mean, I'm not out of my mind to say. And before you know it, if those balls start flying over, guess what's going to happen? I'm going to be in touch with you guys, and it's not going to be right. Do you want me to call you every day? Do you want me to go to your house and tell you how much noise I'm having?
It's a Challenger program for disabled children.
That's the other thing. Who's policing this thing?
Whoever could be on the field now could still be on the field in a month.
No one's.
I understand your concerns.
I don't think this was addressed correctly.
And I understand your disappointment that the town didn't contact you about the field being built there.
Ms. Lieberman, you have anything you could say on it?
Say is I'm sorry that the town didn't notify you, which they really should have done some notification. But the other thing is that, and I just really can't speak for the board, but the only thing I want to say is that we hold the permits. We are promising you that the only one who can use that field, and then we can talk about how we can police it and what we can do to try to in any way help the situation, not exacerbate it. But we have to have some other dialogues also.
What about the value of my home and our homes? I have 12 people sign a petition.
I'm going to want to buy a house on a field. So what do I do? I have to move now. I have to tell my kids we're moving because our quality of life is being disrupted.
Okay. In public participation, it's you come up, you speak for 3 minutes. It's a meeting. We're trying to be respectful. We need to all be respectful to each other. You're welcome to come up to the mic and make your point, but you just can't yell out from the audience.
My name is Afshin Ilyadi. I live at 23 Richard Court. I'm right between these two guys. I'm going through the same thing David went through 13 years ago. I just bought my house a couple of months ago, and I don't think the value of my house is going to be the same if the baseball field would be attached to my fence. When I bought it, I did my research. I moved in from Queens, and they told me Plainview is one of the most quiet places, especially on Richard Court. They told me that there is no noise, nothing. That's the only reason I moved to Richard Court, to that area. And then I find out that 2 days ago, they told me that it's going to be a baseball field right behind our fence, which I don't think is fair.
Thank you.
Going to change the topic. My name's Russell.
I don't feel the need to give my last name because I'm not here just to represent my child. It's a group of kids that I think are being wronged. It's Traub if you need it.
The rules say you have to.
I just said it. It's Traub if you need it. But specifically, I want to speak to the college course waiting. I'm not a complainer. I usually leave that role to my wife. But I'm not here to tell you that there's not enough meat on my corned beef sandwich or my bagel wasn't scooped out. I'm here because there's a group of kids, specifically those in these college courses, who are just getting a raw deal. And while I applaud the board and their recommendation, I just want to make a couple of things clear. Specifically, sometimes as educators, you know, you can get the right answer, but you go about it the wrong way. So when I came in today and I see the handout, and in the talking points, it speaks specifically to students have expressed that since there is no waiting for college-level courses, there is no incentive to try their hardest or perhaps challenge themselves. What a complete misrepresentation and inaccurate description of the students who are actually involved in that class. The students who are in there have chosen. They're not the ones who avoided it. They're the ones who jumped in with both feet. And I could tell you firsthand for my child, he is trying his hardest. And I don't want to speak specifics because I don't have all the data. But what I will say is that my child is underperforming in his grade, as many others are. And if it was just my child, so be it. But it's a group of kids. So not only do they get punished for the grade once, but these kids, a lot of them are seniors now who mid-year transcripts will be reviewed by colleges, who now a college looks at a mid-year report, and the lowest grade that they're going to see is a college prep class. It's going to reflect very poorly on the student, perhaps poorly on the district, but again, the recommendation of the board is applauded. I just hope that the committee is applauded. I hope the board recognizes that it goes a little bit deeper and that that's really not an accurate description of the students that you have in that class. You have amongst the best and the brightest children in this program, and they're just completely being wrong. Thank you.
I just want to comment on that one sentence that I think you're reading there. Students express that there's no waiting for college-level courses, that there's no incentive to try their hardest and perhaps challenge themselves. I don't believe that this statement was made about the current students in the course, that perhaps some students don't choose college-level courses because they are not, in fact, weighted. And therefore, why should I challenge myself if there's no incentive or no waiting for these courses? So perhaps the wording it could have been changed or altered in some way, but it was in no way correct. Correct, absolutely. So if it was taken that way, I apologize.
My name is Arlene Schechter. I live at 67 Mitchell Avenue. And I'm also here to discuss the college weighting of the courses. I just want to say one other thing that Russell talked about. The kids who are in the college level, for instance, calculus, are kids who accelerated way back in eighth grade. When they got to be seniors this year and they wanted to continue, they chose a class that they opted not to take AP, but they opted to take a calculus class. At this point, they're only stuck with the super calculus class, which I'm all for, and I'm all for them challenging themselves. But as Russell said, as a whole, it seems amongst the parents that have discussed it, that all those children are really getting grades more similar to that they've gotten in honors or AP classes before this. And I don't think the seniors for this year, when the colleges get their transcripts, it's going to look like they're not working as hard. That's my concern, that it's going to look, when the college get their mid-year grades, that all of a sudden on this regular level class where they've been performing however they've been performing for 3 years, it's going to look as though they've pretty much dropped the ball because they're seniors. So I really implore you to make the change and make the change this year. So at least when the colleges get their transcripts, even though it's not weighted on the transcript, they see that the designation on the class, that class or Spanish or any class, is honors or however you decide to designate it. And I did speak with both the teacher who's teaching the super calculus class and someone at Syracuse, and they did tell me that the curriculum of the super calculus class is the same curriculum as the AP calculus class that they put forth. The only difference is the pacing in the teaching of the curriculum and when they finish it. So I really do think the change should be made for this year, especially because the kids had no other option. There is no regular calculus class. It's that or nothing at this point, and they've all registered for it before they knew that.
Hi, I'm Terry Glogauer, 75 Plymouth Road. I also have a son who is in the super calculus, and I also contacted Syracuse, and in fact, they gave me the course of the MAT 295, and it is considered an AP AB Cal course. So if it has the AP attached to it, then it should be weighted at a 7% and not a 5%. And so if that's the case, then on the transcript, it also should be noted as an AP course, as they won't get the grades or the weighted grade until the end of the year, but that AP will then signify to the colleges the level, the rigor, and the coursework was at a college AP level. Because to be very honest, it is a college course here, but the college actually labels it as an AP in their curriculum, in their guide. And that's something that we were never, ever, ever told. I also want to go back and talk about the algebra results. I have a big question about how you made a comparison to the 2005 Regents exam versus the results of the new Common Core when the students never took the 2005 Regents exam. So you're norming children who took the 2005 Regents exam from another time period to our children who didn't do the 2005 course load, who took the Common Core course load, who took the Common Core Regents, and there's no norming in that. How do you compare apples to oranges? That's very, very confusing to me. I don't understand that. And in all, it's not win-win, because I know myself and other parents have children that perform very low on that Regents, and it did negatively impact on their transcript. And we should only be about win-win for the kids. Even if there's one child where it negatively impacted, we should question it. We should be concerned about that. Thank you. Yeah, I don't know how to do this. Okay.
Hi, Sabina Pacheckley, 41 Mitchell Avenue, and I'm going to piggyback on what Terry said, because when we first spoke about it this summer, Dr. Lewis said that she would absolutely consider it, because our neighboring districts did talk about either removing the Regents from their overall grade average or giving them a weighted percentage. That was not even brought up to the committee, which I find really disturbing, because if that's what the superintendent promised for the committee to consider, it wasn't even considered. So where did that, why is that falling on the wayside? My daughter, and I can only speak for my daughter and some of her friends, who it did negatively impact, who did have over a 90-something average without that Regents, when it brought her down. So she is a very hardworking child. She did persevere during the year, and then she was penalized for it. So I hope the board considers that when they vote on that. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Judy Ornstein, 20 Linda Lane. I want to piggyback also on the discussion of super calculus. Unlike what I understand to be the case for a lot of parents, I did understand that this was a harder course than the regular high school level calculus course, but that's because I teach in a high school and I know the super program. Had I not taught in a high school, I would have been in the same situation. My concern is not only that has been already addressed by people, but my concern is also that I feel, I've only been here 2 years, and I feel that the district needs to be a little bit more open to allowing parent choice to level and speed at which kids take courses. I know that there's open discussion right now about the whole algebra for all eighth graders. I know that's not on the agenda tonight, and my kids thankfully are past that. I'm completely opposed to that because parents should have a choice as to when their kids should take what classes. And I felt the same way about the calculus because I know my son, and I know that my son dies in the daily grind but rises to the occasion on big standardized tests. I'm not going to say his SAT scores. I'm a little proud. He didn't crack a book, tell you. Didn't crack a book. Did okay. But I know that about him. But when I said that I thought that he would actually do better in the ABAP than in the SUPA because I knew what it was, I was told nope, because the AP, AB calculus was only for kids that had been in honors pre-calc, and he hadn't. And in the end, that has resulted in him being in a class that's actually worse for him than the other one would have been. So I would like the board to consider and just bear in mind, let parents who know their kids have more choice in which classes the kids go into. Don't just tell parents everybody has to do this, or this class is only for kids that have done that, or this class has to be for every kid. Respect parents and respect parents' knowledge of their kids, please.
Mrs. Ornstein, thank you for your feedback. One of the things that also came out of some discussions was some feedback for parents about our college courses and being, I'm using the word transparent, but I don't know if that's the correct word to use, but being able to present the different course options and explaining the difference between taking a SUPA calculus class, whether it be the pacing, the content of those courses, the end exams in those, how grades are calculated, and doing that more during the time when students are selecting courses. And that was a discussion that Mr. Murray, Ms. Lynn, and myself have had in how do we do that, and having the chair people and directors of the different departments involved in that conversation, and whether we have a parent night that addresses those points, and for not those parents that aren't able to attend those evening presentations, putting something in the course catalog that more specifically defines that. So I appreciate your feedback, and that is something that we recognize we can do better, and we will do that going forward.
Jacques Wolfner, 151 Sutton Drive. I want to address some items on the agenda. On item 8.5, I see we're approving a contract for July and August of 2015. That's sort of after the fact. We should be approving contracts before they're awarded, not after. Unless I misread the agenda, that seems to be the case. I also want to request some information on the bond issue. We just had a presentation of a lot of work being done, and it was my understanding up to this point we were financing this out of current funds, but are we going to be seeking financing in the form of bond anticipation notes, or are we at the point where we're going to be floating a bond issue? I'd like some further information on that. And Rich Cunningham talked to the board about the TRS contributions. There's also one other thing. I know it's much smaller, but the ERS, the Employees Retirement System, contributions are also coming down, and the board should be aware of that. Thank you.
Rich, do you want to answer the question about bond anticipatory notes and where that schedule is, if you have that available?
Sure. I had met with our financial advisors in the beginning of October, reviewed project cash flow along with our own cash reserves at that point, or cash balance, and they reviewed our cash flow, and we determined at that time we did not need to borrow. We can't borrow for projects that have not yet been approved and bid. So as we are moving closer to bidding out more projects and presenting contracts for approval to the board, school construction consultants is updating the projected cash flow. We'll pass it on to the fiscal advisors, and we'll look to see if we're starting to go out with a borrowing. You know, if we do borrow, we're probably looking in the April, May, June area. But we really won't know that until we see when SED approves projects and when we get them out to bid. And it's most likely the first borrowing will be a ban, bond anticipation note.
And we'll make sure we put that on an agenda when the appropriate time comes.
So absolutely.
The community can know about it. Thank you.
Stephanie Nelkins, 55 Acorn Lane. So the first question I have about calculus is that I'm just curious because, I mean, from what I'm hearing secondhand, but it's a lot of people. They're saying that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that super calculus was packaged as this replaces the good old POB regular calculus. So now what I'm hearing from a bunch of people is that it seems to be very similar to AP AB level. So I'm just sort of wondering why it seems like a redundancy to have those two kind of calculuses and not have something for the kid who advanced and was good in math, but it maybe not their thing, but they want to do something. Maybe they're going into some sort of major that doesn't involve any kind of math. And yes, I know a lot of certain schools, you know, it's been explained, and I appreciate that, what some schools look for and this and that. But there are just some people in the world that it just math isn't for them. But considering you make a decision back in sixth grade and you start a commitment in seventh grade, that's a lot of years. That's, you know, this is your crown and glory of 6 years. And to not have an opportunity for just a regular diet calculus, let's say, or calculus light, just something that gives you an interest, whatever it is, whatever it was, apparently, was that a good one? Whatever it is, but for some people, that's where it is. It just might not be there. I'm like that BC Cal kid. You know, that's not for everyone, but it doesn't mean that the diet calculus or whatever that introductory course, as it turns out to be, isn't a great achievement for these kids. And it isn't something that could help them if they do decide to have a major and they do need to take something in college. But certainly to feel defeated, certainly to leave a class and go into a stats class, that's not helping them on their calculus path. And something you need to think about, too, is, you know, my cohort that I talk about a lot, we're the Common Core math kids. I've been coming here for a bunch of years about this, week after week. We've had a lot of challenges. We still have a lot of challenges. It bothers me that a Regents that's so different and so unusual that it's only going to be someone's best guess, and quite frankly, our curriculum is only someone's best guess. I tutor enough kids in enough different districts that everyone has a different twist on Common Core geometry even. I mean, even the algebra, things are done, things are focused on. It's not all the same thing. So whatever's going on here, hey, look, I hope it matches up with whatever that exam is, but knowing that there's a big chunk of that grade involved in that, I just feel it's not okay. So for whatever that's worth, I just feel this is something you know nothing about. You know nothing about curving is going to be. The Regents is very unpredictable, as we can see what's going on in algebra, how things changed. It seemed that we did enjoy a very high curving in prior Algebra 2 trig Regents exams. Who knows what that's going to be? I mean, kids even as high as a 98 were curved up. So who knows what they're going to do with this? Yet kids are going into that. There are all these topics. I received a list of differences of topics amongst the two tests, and you really can't make all this up. It looks like some of this is now going into pre-calculus, and actually this list doesn't jive with the information I received from contacts I have at State Ed. There's a couple of questions that I would even want to talk about because there are some things that they felt were in there that aren't, and things that, like, what happened to them, are those being covered? So I still have, you know, very specific questions about this that I would need to talk about. But just to do something positive, there's a book out. It's made by the Topical Review Company. They're the ones who make those little green Regents books that everyone comes home with. And they have these great little books. This one is Algebra 2 Trigonometry, Made Easy. And it's a whopping $3.50. It's not something that's readily available in a store. I'm not here because, you know, I'm pushing this for them, although they happen to be a great company and they're very nice to talk to on the phone. But I just feel that to provide kids with something to have for someone who's trying to self-study on their own, to try to prepare for this Regents, and to give them something that they could have right now. First of all, this will be a reference. There are certain aspects of the course, the Common Core Algebra 2 course, that overlap. This could be a reference. It's a great book. I've read the first 100 pages myself, and I think it's very well written and actually very well done. It was definitely a labor of love by these teachers, and it really solidifies things, and it's a good explanation. So again, for $3.50, for the kids that are caught up in this mess, to get something in their hands. Look, some of them may not use it. Maybe they don't care. But for those that want to have it, you're giving them something as if you're recognizing to say, you know what, guys, you've been struggling all these years. You have kids that are devastated. They waited until a few days before the quarter ended to drop out of honors Common Core Algebra 2. Again, these kids, all those years that they tried and they persevered and they made it through the algebra, the guinea pig year. They made it through honors geometry. And they really, really tried. And they're upset as well. And you know what? Again, throw kids a bone, something. And there are things out there, but no one's going to know about this.
Can you leave me a copy?
If you want to give me a security deposit, absolutely.
Thank you. I'll give it back to you in the same condition.
It's a little dented. It's okay.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Gardos, 21 Melbourne Lane, Old Bethpage. I wanted to say that I'm very disappointed with the recommendations of the committee with regards to the algebra regents that was given this past June. I was at the board meeting in August of 2015. At that meeting, Dr. Lewis stated, and this is in the minutes because I looked tonight, Dr. Lewis specifically stated how difficult the Algebra Common Core exam was. She went on to discuss how neighboring districts interpreted the state education department's directives differently. They offered the integrated algebra regents and the Common Core algebra regents. Our students suffered because our district did not interpret it the same way, and our students were not given the same opportunities. Now, I don't have the data to show the differences in the scores between those two regions, but anecdotally, I'm told they were between 10 and 20 points different. That difference impacts upon our students' transcripts, on our students' college opportunities. We were told at that meeting by Dr. Lewis and the board that there would be a meeting with the teachers to come up with a plan to discuss the grading and how it will be reflected on the students' transcript. Dr. Lewis specifically told us that the board has the authority to change the grading and weighting policy. I implore this board to disregard the recommendations made by this committee and to take the interests of our students into account, to take into account the difficulty of this region. While a lot is to be made of the cohort who is currently taking Algebra 2, the cohort who is currently taking geometry was the first cohort in this district not to be offered the opportunity to take two regents and to have the best score counted. Please consider the math prospects of these students who are suffering with the first real year of this new and untested curriculum. These students are suffering. I also dispute the statement that data was presented demonstrating the impact upon Common Core Algebra on students' grades and that the point difference was minimal. When I went to school, when I assume most of you went to school, the Regent was an exam that helped the students' grades. This Common Core Regent hurt almost every student. I can speak from my experience that this Regent lowered my daughter's grade, and from the clapping behind me, I'm assuming that most people were in that same position. Please reconsider. Please either wait this region or do not count it on our students' grades, penalizing them. Thank you. Shari Naxon, 30 Briarwood Lane, Plainview. I want to go in the other direction, eighth grade. I have one in calculus, AP, and one in eighth grade. I'm finding with eighth grade, honestly, not so much my kid, and I see it more with my senior, who is tutoring all these eighth graders, because they only have remedial twice a week, where a kid taking algebra in ninth grade is offered 5 days a week. I want to know, now that we're thinking of pushing all the eighth graders, do we have a plan in place for helping all these kids that are going to suffer? Because I'm seeing the kids suffer now. As I said, I'm seeing it from the other direction. I'm seeing that our future is going to be for the haves and have-nots of kids that can afford tutors. My senior is telling me that my younger one is doing 10th grade math. I don't think 10th grade math is appropriate for an 8th grader. It's 10th grade honors math, not 10th grade regions math. I think that pushing kids just for the sake of pushing kids isn't valuable. And I hope we consider actually how our kids can perform in that situation.
I just want to note that with regard to Algebra for All, that is a board goal just to explore it at this point. So no decisions have been made. So we do appreciate the feedback that you're providing.
What about for current kids that only get the 2 days a week remedial versus five that you would get if you took the course in high school?
Well, it's 4 days at the high school for remedial. If teachers are providing an extra day, I applaud them, but in their contract, it's 4 days. In the middle schools, it's 2 days, and I would agree that that's not the same, but again, it's an accelerated program, and going into it, that is the contract at the middle school level. So I appreciate the feedback.
It's a shame for the kids.
Good evening. Susan Stewart, 36 Bluebird Lane, Plainview, New York. I just wanted to talk about two subjects that kind of roll into one another. The significant difference of 0.68, that was the number, am I correct? Am I repeating that right? Okay, 0.68 in a GPA can open and close doors on merit and honor programs on a transcript. The top 5% of a school's applicants can get between $15,000 and $30,000 in merit scholarships in different schools. You can look it up. It's not, and as common application makes this the college application process more competitive and more selective, 0.68 will affect many students. Now let's roll into SUPA, because we don't have, as Stephanie wants to call it, calculus light. My daughter took that POB calculus class because she was taking so many APs, she needed one place to break. Now, we're with my son's the cohort of Algebra 2. We're going to backfill, according to the Algebra 2 parent meeting, a lot of trigonometry topics into pre-calc. Will they be ready for possibly a college level, either APAB or Super Mat 295, if we're putting so much time into backfilling trigonometry? So we're not, and right now the course catalog does not offer that non-college level. So again, these students for the fifth year, next year, will be testing a new curriculum. It won't be a Regents exam, but it'll be a new curriculum just the same. And then if we're staying with an AP or college level only curriculum, the only choice they're going to have is stats. Is that fair? When kids want to, we've talked about this, that the reason why we're pushing our kids to go to an accelerated program in middle school is so we can have calculus at the end, not AP stat. Right. So, I mean, I think this all starts to snowball into one big conversation. Also, are we setting a precedent? Because now, even if the state says we can take the 2005 A2 trig, with all the stuff that has to be backfilled, will they be ready to take an A2 trig exam, get a great grade on it, or even a passing grade on it? Do we have that choice again? So then are we just putting a bad precedent that we're not going to look at the weighting per individual student? These are just questions that need to be thought of, and I hope that you take the time to digest all this information before voting on these recommendations.
All right, I thank everyone for their participation, and now we move to routine business. Don't we have to hold something? Do I have a motion for routine business? Debbie? Lauren? Any hold separations?
Can we hold 8.2?
Okay. Motion to hold 8.2. Second, Emily. All those in favor of holding 8.2? Okay, so all those in favor of everything except 8.2. All right. That was everybody. Right, Jody? That was everybody? So we have a motion, new business. We have additional staff development proposals. Lauren? Second, Debbie. Discussions? All those in favor? NASA Community College Partnership Remedial Workshops. Ginger? Seth? Discussion? Sure.
So this goes back to the NASA Community College Partnership that we had, where those students who choose to go to Nassau Community College, we give them a placement exam. We actually give them the placement exam ahead of time, more so as a practice to see how they would do. And for those students where they would not place out of the ACCUPLACER, we provide remedial time for them to catch them up between now and then taking the exam again. They actually take the exam on Plainview site with the support of Nassau Community College, and Dr. Lewis has spoken about this numerous times, about the number of students we've been able to catch where they would not be taking a remedial course, particularly in English. We do have a few students in mathematics, but again, this isn't a great opportunity for kids and to really remediate those specific areas in time for them not to have to take that college, that basically the high school college course again.
Thank you.
All those in favor? Okay, motion for Board of Education approval field trip for Stratford. Jody, Lauren, discussions? All those in favor? Okay, math workshops for parent community at Old Bethpage. Well, first I got a motion. Seth, Emily, explanation, discussions?
Okay, so the math workshops at Old Bethpage Elementary School, Mrs. Gray in the past has provided grade level workshops for her parents through her PTA functions, which oftentimes have been during the day. This year, she would like to propose doing some during the evening. And although she's had teachers there in the past, I would request that our teachers be paid for giving of their time during the evening. So it would be the math specialist and also a representative from each grade level in providing those workshops for parents.
Will this be happening in our other three elementary schools?
So the elementary principals gathered together, and they were just talking about the different parent workshops that they wanted to offer. Mrs. Gray had already had some of hers planned, mm-hmm. but I do anticipate that the other principals will be coming up with some type of schedule on their own, whether it be some during the day and some in the evening. But I can't give the specifics of that. Mrs. Gray was just a little ahead in her planning.
Thank you.
All those in favor? All right, Delta resolution. Do I have a motion? Emily, Ginger, discussion? All those in favor? All right, do I have a motion to adjourn for...
Wait.
I'm sorry.
Jacques also had a question about the contract that we were approving. And although it was after the fact, Jacques, I can ask Rich to speak to that, but I do see the timeline of that is off, and that is something that we have been and will address with our administrators in providing that to the board in a timely manner. We recognize that that should not occur.
I want to amend new business to appoint a community member to represent the Board of Education at the NASA BOCES Budget Advisory Committee.
Anyone we know who's sitting here in
the front row? Let me take a guess. Mr. Wolfner.
All those in favor?
Thank you, Jacques.
Well, sorry we didn't get that on the agenda, but we got it in time, right? Okay, now, do I have a motion to appoint Jacques Wolfner as our delegate to BOCES for the... Ginger, Jody, all those in favor. Congratulations, Jacques. You're doing it again.
Do I have to accept?
I think it's mandatory. Okay, Emily?
I just wanted to say thank you to SNAP for once again making a donation of some equipment for the use of our special needs students.
So I have a motion to adjourn into executive session for purpose of negotiations. Emily, Seth, all those in favor? Good night, everybody. Thank you. I know it was a long meeting. We'll see you in 2 weeks.